Ian has given us a brilliant skewering of a system that has gone crazy over this issue of the threat of terrorism. And I think what he's done is to lay out in he's illuminated a pattern of behavior in the United States in which these political and bureaucratic interests have, you know, glommed on to an issue and exploited it to maximize their personal and institutional power and wealth, as in the case of certain individuals. He has touched on the military side of this, the way in which the war in Iraq was a product of this this phenomenon that he describes. I want to focus in my remarks on the military side of this problem. And in doing so, I want to back up just a bit and suggest that what we face in terms of the military logic, the military dynamics that underlie what has happened since 9/11 is really, I would argue, far more serious than simply a neocon conspiracy. I'm not denying that there was a neocon conspiracy, don't get me wrong. What we're talking about here is a small group of individuals within the Bush administration who were strategically placed to take advantage of the terror attacks in 9/11 to advance their own agenda, just as Ian said. But underlying that, there is a much broader, much deeper problem, which I want to try to analyze for you in just a few moments. And that is that the U.S. military bureaucracy, the U.S. national security bureaucracy writ large, and within that particularly the military service bureaucracy, is a congeries of organizations which also act precisely in the way that Ian has described with regard to the FBI and other bureaucratic entities in their response to 9/11. That is to say that these bureaucratic organizations act in such a way as to maximize their institutional interests, not to maximize a theoretical national interest or an objective national interest. And in putting forward this analytical construct, let me just say that this is not a radical notion, this is not a left-wing notion, it's not a right-wing notion. It is based on the observations of not, you know, some ivory tower intellectuals, but those students of bureaucracy and specifically the military bureaucracy who have been closest to and longest in their observation of the problem. Let me read to you from a book by Carl H. Bilder, a RAND Corporation military analyst, who has been working on analyzing the process of making military policy for decades. He wrote a book called The Masks of War, published in 1989, in which he made the following statement. To say that the motivation behind a military services strategy is less about national security than the service's interest is not the same as saying that the service does not give a hoot about national defense, but that it just wants to keep its empire alive and is willing to fabricate a strategy in order to do so. Now, this is somebody who is very devoted to the military as an institution, very supportive of it, not a critic of it in the sense that he wants to bring it down, but who is very realistic about the way it operates. The problem that I want to describe to you is, and this is the irony of the military's relationship to terrorism as an issue. Before 9/11, the U.S. military had absolutely no interest in terrorism as an issue on which the military itself should have a major role. This is a phenomenon which emerges if you look at the 9/11 Commission report, but even more so if you probe beneath the surface of the narrative that we've gotten about the road to 9/11. There are a number of stories which illuminate the relationship between the military service chiefs, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the Joint Staff in the Pentagon, and, I have to add, their civilian allies, the Secretary of Defense, the deputies, and so on and so forth, the civilians who run the Pentagon in alliance with the military services, and how they reacted when the counterterrorism specialists in the White House, State Department, and to some extent the Pentagon itself were advocating a policy of going after Osama bin Laden's safe haven in Afghanistan, beginning roughly in 1996, but picking up speed and impetus, particularly after the Al-Qaeda bombing of two U.S. embassies in August of 1998, U.S. embassies in East Africa. It was at that point that the counterterrorism specialists in the U.S. government, the national security state, were becoming more aggressive about advocating some action to deal with the bin Laden, the Al-Qaeda safe haven in Afghanistan. And there were proposals formulated, particularly by a man named Sheehan in the State Department, the State Department's counterinsurgency, Michael Sheehan, the State Department's counterinsurgency, counterterrorism director, was advocating that the United States have a plan to go into Afghanistan to support particularly the Northern Alliance of anti-Taliban forces, which the State Department had up to that time and the U.S. government had basically said, we're neutral, we're not going to support anybody, we don't have a dog in this fight in Afghanistan, it's not our fight. And when these proposals were in play within the bureaucracy, Sheehan has told the story that the Joint Staff and the military brass were distinctly unsympathetic. They wanted nothing to do with it. They were arguing that that this was, first of all, this would be a an intelligence operation. It was not a military of military interest. That it would be a quagmire. And Sheehan recalls that a very senior special operations officer who had been on the Joint Staff during this period of the late 1990s told him more than once that this officer had heard terrorist strikes against Americans, American interests, American targets, characterized as, quote, a small price to pay for being a superpower. So one has to ask the question, what's going on here? Why is the U.S. military bureaucracy so distinctly uninterested in supporting any operation in Afghanistan to go after bin Laden? The intelligence is very clear that the Al-Qaeda operation, the Al-Qaeda organization, was behind a series of terrorist attacks against American troops, against American military installations, and against U.S. civilian targets in the Middle East, and there are others that I haven't named, which U.S. intelligence was able, by August or September of 1998, to establish very clearly as being Al-Qaeda operations. But the answer, I think, becomes clear from looking at the way in which the military operates and the way in which it responded later on to 9/11. That is that the military does not do counterterrorism. The military bureaucracy, the Army, Navy, Air Force, and the Pentagon civilian bureaucracy itself were not organized to do terrorism or counterterrorism operations. This was not their idea of the war that they were prepared to fight. The military bureaucracy operates according to the principle that each service organizes to fight a particular kind of war or a set of wars. They choose their weapon systems, their organization, their doctrines, their roles and missions to fight specific kinds of wars. And they ask for and get their military budget based on fighting particular kinds of wars. And when a particular issue comes along that does not fit the kind of wars that they want to fight, that they're prepared to fight, and that they get money to fight, they're not interested. And so in the run-up to 9/11, when the counterterrorist people were saying, we have to do something about al-Qaeda, we have to do something about bin Laden, we have the instruments here at hand to do something. We need to go in support of the Northern Alliance. We need to have finite numbers of troops ready to support them and to have other military operations that would support that. The Pentagon was not interested. After 9/11, the headline is, this did not change fundamentally. In the aftermath of 9/11, when the neocon conspiracy was working on turning that opportunity into a war in Iraq, but also into a strategy for overthrowing regimes throughout the Middle East, including Iran and Syria, Lebanon, primarily, of course, Hezbollah, but basically going in and rearranging the politics of Lebanon, Libya, Sudan, Somalia. And this, by the way, is confirmed in Douglas Feith's new book, War and Decision. He actually quotes from the document that was presented by Donald Rumsfeld to President Bush on September 30th, which presented a strategy for a so-called war on terror, which would not, in fact, be against terrorism at all. It would not be directed against al-Qaeda. It was directed against all the regimes in the Middle East who were regarded as not pro-American and pro-Israeli. Why was that? That's because, of course, the neocons were interested in overthrowing regimes. They didn't care about terrorists. That was not what they were interested in. But what I'm trying to emphasize here is that it was not just the neocons. The U.S. military establishment was on board with that concept. According to Feith, when that memo, that paper, went to from Rumsfeld to Bush, it had already been vetted with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Henry Shelton, Army general, who was just leaving, and he was being replaced by an Air Force general, Richard Myers. He was also consulted. And the commander of CENTCOM, General Abizaid, was also consulted about this paper. And according to Feith, and I'm trying now to get each of these three generals to confirm this, and I've been working on this for the last 48 hours, to get them to comment. None of them have responded to my inquiries so far. We'll see if they do respond. I suspect they will not be willing to comment. But according to Feith, they all gave their approval. In the case of Abizaid, he said he was enthusiastic about this idea. And the memo was specifically presenting the objective of regime change in a series of regimes. Now, Feith blanks out, deletes the names of the countries which were to be the target for regime change. But we know from Wes Clark's 2003 book that it was the seven countries that I've named. Afghanistan, I didn't name Afghanistan, but Afghanistan was the first, followed by Iraq, Iran, Syria, Lebanon, Sudan, Libya, and Somalia. Those were the names of the countries who were to be targets for regime change. Now, Bush did not accept that as a national policy. But 3 days later, Rumsfeld made that an official Pentagon strategic guidance for all commanders in the so-called war on terror. And what I want to point out, what I want to get across here is that this really is the origin of the concept of the war on terror, the global war on terror. It was in the Pentagon from Rumsfeld, drafted by Douglas Feith, Paul Wolfowitz, approved by Rumsfeld, but also vetted with the military leadership, and it had nothing to do with al-Qaeda. None of those countries, except for Afghanistan, was being accused. Douglas Feith does not claim that there was any evidence or that they believed that any of those countries were involved in 9/11 or were involved in supporting al-Qaeda. It was simply that these were enemy states. In some way or shape, they were accused of supporting terrorism of some kind, but this was an opportunity to take down our regimes that are associated with enemy states. So the war on terror was never intended to be about al-Qaeda, about those who carried out 9/11. It was simply a device for the neocons and for the U.S. military to have a set of tasks that had to do with taking down regimes. And I'll close by a quote from an anonymous officer who, in a conversation with General Wes Clark in November of 2001, just a few weeks after this document became, it was turned into an official Pentagon guidance for commanders, strategic guidance for commanders. He told Wes Clark, "We are not good at counterterrorism. We're good at taking down regimes." Now, what he meant by that, of course, was that we're not interested in counterterrorism because it does not fit the needs of the military bureaucracy for maintaining their budget, their weapon systems, their personnel, their roles and missions, and their doctrines. What does do that is regime change, because that requires military occupation. That requires a major military operation in any state where it's going to be done. So again, it's not only the neocons who responded to 9/11 by exploiting the opportunity to attack state enemies and not terrorists. It was the U.S. military. Now, I don't have time to go into this, but there is a sequel. And that sequel is, of course, that now that the Iraq War has become the war for the U.S. military, that, of course, then had to be used to promote the military's interest in saying that, well, we are doing something about terrorism, and Iraq is the template, Iraq is the model for how the United States should do terrorism. And there is a quote from the head of the special operations in the U.S. Army, in the U.S. Pentagon, excuse me, General William Boykin, Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence and Warfighting Support. He said in April of 2005 that the anti-insurgency tactics the U.S. military is learning in Iraq could be applied globally, which would turn the war on terrorism into a, quote, war on insurgency. And so what we're seeing here is the, again, military bureaucracies, like any other bureaucracy, it's not special to the military, like any other bureaucracy, maintains its empire, as Carl Bilder said, by manufacturing a strategy, manufacturing doctrine that will fit their own bureaucratic needs. That's the problem that we face. And it is not something that any existing political movement, party, organization is geared to deal with. And that is what I believe the Independent Institute and all other well-intentioned organizations in this country ought to be really focusing on. Thank you.